We've been in this study now for 3 weeks, and in those 3 weeks, we kind of crept along through chapter one. First of all, examining the Adam to Noah genealogy and the circumstances by which those people were born and named and how it pointed forward to Christ. Then the next study, we looked at the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and how each of them were individually, and then how their lineages or proved to be the people that their sons and their grandsons, great-grandsons, the peoples that came from them, how they were, who they were, and most importantly, I think we focused in on where they ended up. And then finally, we looked at the sons of Abraham. This was just last week. We saw Isaac and Ishmael, and we saw that Isaac was the son of promise, and then Isaac had two sons, Esau and Jacob was the son of the promise. That's called the Abrahamic covenant, for people who like $2 words, the Abrahamic covenant. God said, hey, Abraham, I'm making a deal with you. It's a covenant. So now it's the Abrahamic covenant that then Isaac and then Jacob inherited. And tonight, we're looking at pretty much from chapter 2 through 9, which shows us the chronicler, the author of this book, shows us the sons of Jacob. Remember, Jacob was renamed Israel, and so tonight you'll find me interchanging the words Jacob and Israel because it's the same guy, and depending on where we are reading or where my brain is, it'll either be Jacob or Israel. So we pick up with chapter 2, verse 1. When we read, these are the sons of Israel, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Joseph, Benjamin, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. Can you imagine mom like yelling, you know, Judah's up to no good, and she starts yelling, Simeon, Gad, Issachar, what is your name? There's 12 kids here, plus a daughter, Dinah. You know, that she's not mentioned much. She was always at the beach. And where's Dinah? Oh, Dinah? The shore. You didn't just get that? You didn't? What did I get the R for before? How do you know she wasn't always at the beach? Anyway, Dinah isn't mentioned because she really doesn't support the lineage or the 12 tribes there. But and really, I was just being facetious about mom because really in this whole mess of 12 sons, there's four moms. Now, that might sound like the latest thing of Montel or Maury or Jerry Springer or whoever. And in fact, when you read it, it really does kind of read like that. It reads like divorce court or something, you know, when you hear about all these people's problems, that in fact, Jacob's sons were from four different women. Now, in his defense, the sordid family story did not start out to be a sordid family story. Well, it kind of did. You see, Jacob had deceived his way into getting the blessing from his father Isaac. You remember when he dressed up like Esau, hairy and smelly and stuff, and Isaac was blind, he couldn't see, and Jacob ended up stealing the blessing from his older brother Esau. He ripped off the blessing. Esau, you know, if you're a peaceful man, a man of the kitchen, as basically Genesis describes him, he's mom's favorite. You know, you probably don't want to play really bad tricks on your older brother. Number one, you know, he wasn't that much older. He was like 30 seconds older. They were fraternal twins. But this guy's a hunter. He's got weapons. He's a man of the field. He's in good shape. And he's kind of a hothead. And so Esau, when he discovered he was ripped off, said, I'm going to kill that little brother of mine. Jacob takes off. Now, Jacob takes off and he goes and meets up with his uncle Laban. Now, Laban, you can tell Laban's part of the family of Jacob, because he is just as deceitful and dishonest as Jacob is. And Laban tricks Jacob. Jacob is working for Laban for the price of marrying Laban's daughter, Rachel. Now, Rachel was beautiful, and Jacob loved her and worked, and they finally had this wedding. Well, you know, the veil in the wedding was a little more opaque than they are nowadays. And so it turned out after the wedding and then the wedding night and then the next morning, turned out he'd married the wrong woman. You see, Uncle Laban had put the older and, the Bible notes, uglier sister, Leah, in her place, had deceived Jacob after Jacob had worked all these years to marry Rachel. And so then he agrees to work some more years for Rachel. And so now he's got two wives. He's got Leah that he doesn't like at all, really. And he's got Rachel that he loves a lot. Well, they have, you know, they're married. And so Leah has children here. Rachel, unfortunately, couldn't have children. And so Leah was the first one to have children by Jacob. And she gave birth to four sons. That was Reuben and Simeon and Levi and Judah. These four boys grew up to be men and grew up to be the patriarchs of four of the tribes of Judah, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Now, Rachel couldn't have children, and so she did what, well, remember what Sarah had done when she couldn't have children because she was 90 years old, you know? She said, well, here's my maidservant, Hagar. She can be like a surrogate mother. Well, this whole idea of the surrogate mother thing, Rachel thought, okay, I'll do that. And so her maid, Bilhah, she was given to Jacob saying, you know, be a surrogate mom. And so Jacob was just, again, doing what he was told. And now he's got two wives and a concubine, basically. And Bilhah gives birth to Dan and then to Naphtali, these two sons. And then Leah, who had had the four sons first, watched this happening and started getting jealous. And so she says, well, here, take, you know, she wasn't having any more kids at this point. So she said, take my maidservant Zilpah. And so Zilpah ended up giving birth to Gad and Asher. And then Leah conceived again. She had kids after this and conceived Issachar and Zebulun. And finally, Rachel, you remember Rachel's the one kind of left out in the cold in the midst of all this, the one who was originally loved, but she hasn't had any children. She finally does conceive and gives birth to Joseph. You remember Joseph. He was the one that all the other brothers hated and ended up selling off to slavery, and you're probably familiar with the story there in Genesis. Joseph, and then later in Rachel's life, really at the end of her life, she conceived, gave birth to Benjamin, the youngest son of Israel, son of Jacob, except she died in childbirth. And so Benjamin was the last son by these four women. And you count it up and you get 12 here, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Joseph, Benjamin, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. Now, from chapter 2, verse 3, all the way, I've marked this up here, pretty much all the way to chapter 4, verse 23, the vast majority of chapters 2 and through 4 here is dedicated to the details of the tribe of Judah, how Judah had these sons, and these sons ended up with sons, and those, you know, and going on and tracing all the family lines. And essentially, the chronicler, Judah is his main focus, and the reason for that is most likely because his whole idea here is chronicling the kings, and you know the kings, other than King Saul, all the kings were from the tribe of Judah, and so once he gets through chapter 9, then his whole focus is on the kings, David and Solomon and Rehoboam, and it goes on down the line. So he focuses in on Judah with almost two complete chapters here, three, four. My math was bad, but almost three complete chapters here. And it's interesting because Judah is the kingly line. And the way you can remember this is that the symbol of Judah is the lion. That was what was on their standard or their banner, you know, the Judah. And ultimately the Messiah, Jesus Christ, came from that line, and he's actually called the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And you can remember that the lion is the king of the beasts, and you can put all that together in your head and hopefully remember that the tribe of Judah is the kingly line. Now, they're the kingly line, but I don't know that their behavior really justified any of that. You can see just at the beginning, if we go back to chapter 2 and just catch verses 2 and 3 of chapter 2. The sons of Judah were Ur. Now, this is funny because when he was born, you know, it's like, what are we going to name him? And Judah's like, you know, and they're okay. That's on the birth certificate. Onan and Shelah. Now, these three were born to him by Bathshua the Canaanitess. Interesting. The Canaanitess. Do you remember that account in Genesis where Judah left his brothers and went off into the land and fell in love with this Canaanite woman and married her? This was something they weren't supposed to do, and yet we see what happened. You can track that down in about Genesis 38, I think. And she became the mother of Ur and Onan and Shelah, and the note here is made, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, so he put him to death. And so basically was so evil that God killed him. Now, he was married at this point. Had a wife. Her name was Tamar. She was supposed to continue the family line down from Judah to The only way she could do that was to follow the law, which says the brother is essentially supposed to marry her and have children in his name, so that all worked out that way. Well, Onan didn't like that idea at all, and so he did not fulfill the obligations he was supposed to, and God ultimately put him to death for not fulfilling the obligations to his brother's wife as well. Again, don't really want to go into the details there, but Genesis 38, nice gross chapter to read. This woman then, Tamar, there was only one brother left, you know. And at this point, Judah was thinking, well, my first son married this woman and now he's dead. My second son kind of married this woman. Now he's dead. I've got one son left. What should I do? He said, you should wait. Don't marry him. And so when this woman saw that she had been dealt with treacherously, she basically disguised herself as a prostitute and ended up conceiving children with her father-in-law, who was Judah. Just a really messed up kind of family, and she ended up giving birth to Perez and Zerah. These were twins, and that lineage, Perez, the elder of the two twins, if you trace his lineage down, you'll get to Boaz. You remember Boaz from the book of Ruth. And then a couple generations later, there's Jesse, the father of David, who became the king and ultimately the ancestor of Jesus by his earthly lineage. And so in spite of all this stuff, and as a matter of fact, if you look at it, I know it's in Matthew chapter 1, that you can actually see this. I didn't plan on going here tonight, and I'm probably going to end up running out of time. But it's just interesting to me that as Matthew documents the genealogy of Jesus, it's fascinating to me to kind of, especially as we're going through Chronicles and we're reminded about how corrupt and messed up these people tended to be, that the book of the generations of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah here, by the time you get to verse 3 of Matthew chapter 1, Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron and Hezron the father of Ram. It goes on down till you hit Boaz and then down to Jesse and David. It's interesting to me that right there in the genealogy of Jesus, there's this reminder of all this sin. Judah had Perez and Zerah by Tamar, his daughter-in-law, who disguised herself as a prostitute. I mean, Jesus isn't ashamed of his family history, you know. He actually includes it in there, and it's fascinating to me to be reminded continually that, you know, Jesus has welcomed me, and he's welcomed you if you've been born again, into his family. You're part of the family. And a lot of times we spend so much time trying to cover up the fact that we're wicked, and we shouldn't pursue wickedness, but there's so many people with the plastic faces on, you know, that, oh, I'm super Christian. Hey, I'll tell you what, I'm not super Christian. Talk to anybody in my family, talk to any of my close friends, they will tell you I am not super Christian. And people that pretend to be are usually pretending to be. We're messed up. We're very often like Tamar or Judah. And Jesus is not ashamed to call us brothers and friends and family. He's not. He's not. So just a word of encouragement there. We'll go back to 1 Chronicles. And so we saw that Judah had these three sons, and then he had these two more sons by Tamar. He had five sons in all. And essentially, we go all the way then to 1 Chronicles chapter 4, where verse 24 begins to list the descendants of Simeon. I'm not going to read that to you because we're, you know, frankly, you don't want to hear me mispronounce all the names, and really there's not a lot in here other than the fact that it does note that the descendants of Simeon, the tribe of Simeon, destroyed the remnant of the Amalekites. And so as you're searching through the scriptures and you're looking at the Amalekites, this is the point where, you know, they're done with, and they finally did what God had commanded them to do a long time before. So we get to chapter 5. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn. So we've looked at Judah, and we saw there was Simeon in there. And now Reuben, the firstborn of Israel. Why is he listed third? That's kind of strange. Usually the firstborn is like right, you know, right up front. Well, it says the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel. And then there's a parenthesis, and the author, the chronicler, says, well, he was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the son of Joseph, or the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that he's not enrolled in the genealogy according to the birthright. So it makes note here that he doesn't get the double portion of the firstborn because of something he did. Now, again, it's one of those things that you don't really want to spend a lot of time looking into, but Genesis chapter 35 tells how Reuben sinned because of a lack of self-control, essentially. And then in Genesis 49, when Israel, or Jacob, is on his deathbed, and he's pronouncing prophecies and speaking blessings over all of his sons, when he gets to Reuben, the firstborn, he actually says, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength. But then he points out, he says, you are uncontrolled as water. You shall not have preeminence. Because, and then he describes what he did. So, you know, again, not really a great thing to meditate on, but it's the firstborn gets the authority over the family and the double portion of the blessing, right? Well, he doesn't get the double portion of the blessing. That went to the sons of Joseph, and we'll look at that in a few minutes. Also, he didn't get even the authority over the family because we see in verse 2, though Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came the leader, yet the birthright belonged to Joseph. So it's the chronicler in chapter 5 is beginning this genealogy of Reuben, but right up front he says, well, Reuben, even though he's the firstborn, he doesn't have the double portion. That went to the sons of Joseph, and he doesn't get the authority. That went to Judah, and that's why the kingly line was given to Judah. And again, Genesis 49, a real key chapter, because Jacob, Israel, he's on his deathbed and he's speaking these prophecies and blessings over his 12 sons. And he points out that the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And so he was establishing Judah as having preeminence. And that's why David was able to say later on, as David was the king, he said, hey, you know, God has chosen Judah to be the leader. And we'll see that in 1 Chronicles 28. So, the rest of chapter 5, essentially going through these various tribes from verse 1 to 10 shows the genealogy of Reuben, and then from 11 to 17, there's the descendants of Gad that are detailed in those verses. And so it's talking about Reuben and Gad, and it's about to talk about the half-tribe of Manasseh. And sandwiched in between those three genealogies is this note in verse 18. The sons of Reuben and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, consisting of valiant men, men who bore shield and sword and shot with bow and were skillful in battle, were 44,760 who went to war. They made war against the Hagrites, Jetur, Naphish, and Nodab. They were helped against them, and the Hagrites and all who were with them were given into their hand, for they cried out to the Lord in the battle, and he answered their prayers because they trusted in him. This is a good thing. In the midst of the battle, they're saying, Lord, we can't do this without you. We're crying out in appeal to you. We need your help. And the Lord heard that, answered their prayers, and gave them victory. And so basically it says in verse 22 that many fell slain because the war was of God, and they settled in their place until the exile. Now, this was of God because God had directed it. That doesn't mean all wars are of God, and especially not when, you know, one army is saying, well, you know, God has directed us to do this, and the other army is saying, God has directed us to do this, and it's like, It's kind of like watching the chaplains in the locker rooms before the big game. And they're both teams are, oh, Lord, you know, we really give us the victory. And the Lord's like, oh, great, you both asked. Now what am I going to do? Well, in this case, obviously, only one of them was asking the Lord for victory. And God had told them to go into this battle and destroy these people in the land of Canaan and even outside of the land that had done harm to Israel. And so in this case, the war was of God. So this war was of God, not every war is of God, just to clarify that. Now, then it goes on, verses 23 and 24 talk about the some of the genealogy of the half-tribe of Manasseh. It makes note, though, verse 25, that this half-tribe of Manasseh, they acted treacherously against the God of their fathers and played the harlot after the gods of the peoples of the land, whom God had destroyed before them. Now, you see, they were part of this whole thing with Reuben and Gad, and the half-tribe Manasseh. They said, oh, Lord, help us drive these wicked people out. And then these people became some of the wicked people. The people who had gotten victory now were becoming just like the people that they had driven out. So the God of Israel stirred up even the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, even the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he carried them away into exile, namely the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them to Halah, Habor, Chara, and to the river of Gozan to this day. So here's the story. When they relied on God and they called out to God, victory. What happened when they turned away from God? Defeat. And this was, you remember there was two, how do I abbreviate this? Essentially, Israel was wiped out for a long time by two major invasions. The Assyrian captivity that carried off the 10 tribes, and then later on the Babylonian captivity, which carried off the rest of the folks down in the south. And the Assyrian captivity, when Tiglath-Pileser came in, the Assyrians came in, the first people to get wiped out were Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Why? Well, they were first in line. Why were they first in line? Because when Moses and all the people of Israel finally got to the banks of the Jordan River, the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half of the Manassehites, whatever you call them, looked around and went, we like this side, we're just going to stay. And Moses said, no, you know, this isn't God's best. And what, are you going to bail on your brothers and all that stuff? And they said, well, you know, we have lots of cattle, and this place is good for cattle. And frankly, we have lots of livestock, and this place is good for livestock. And have we mentioned our cattle and our livestock? We're just going to stay here. And so that's what ended up happening, was they stayed there on the wrong side of the Jordan River. Talk about being on the wrong side of the tracks. They chose to be on the wrong side of the river. And so when the Assyrians came in, guess who got it first? They did. They didn't even have that protective border of the Jordan River to even give them some sense of defense. And so they were the first ones to say, oh, we're content not walking in God's perfect will. And they were the first ones to get carted off according to God's judgment. And so we see that happening. Then in chapter 6, really all of chapter 6 talks about the tribe of Levi. Now, chapter 6 with the tribe of Levi, just so many details and people's listed here. I'll just bring out a couple of key points to keep us moving. Verse 1 tells us that the sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. These three guys, it turns out, are actually vitally important because Levi, you remember Levi, when you think of the priests, you think of the Levites. Well, all of the priests were Levites, but not all of the Levites were priests. You see, there was the Merarites and the Kohathites and the otherites, the Gershonites, that these three divisions of the Levites had very specific jobs and assignments from God. So all the people who descended from Gershon, they had a certain job in the tabernacle and later in the temple. And all the people that descended from the Merarites, sounds kind of like an Italian car, because I'm driving a Merari. they had a certain job in the temple and the tabernacle, and the Kohathites, same thing. Now, among the Kohathites was Aaron's descendants. So in the Kohathites, there was the line of Aaron. They were the priests. So you see, there's three big divisions, and only one small part of one of the three divisions were actually priests. So that's why oftentimes you're reading in the scriptures and you'll see the priests and the Levites. The priests are Levites, but not all the Levites are priests. Okay, have I thoroughly confused yet? Good. Essentially, and this is, I think this is the way I divided this up in Deuteronomy 18, and this is from memory, so I may be doing this wrong, but the Merarites, as far as the temple went, they were in charge of the exterior. The Gershonites were in charge of the structure itself, and the Kohathites were in charge of all the furniture. So there's a whole lot of detail in Deuteronomy 18 if you want to go back and really read what their job descriptions were. Or just listen to the tape from Deuteronomy 18 and let me do that for you. And I promise I won't fall asleep on the tape, but you might. All right. I'm just kidding. So these were the three major divisions here. You see that, we can go all the way down to verse 48 kind of summarizes that. Their kinsmen, the Levites, were appointed for all the service of the tabernacle of the house of God. This is what the Levites did, was they cared for the house of God. Now, if I back up to verse 31, this tells us another aspect of being a Levite or part of the Levites. These are those whom David appointed over the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark rested there. So when David brought the Ark of the Covenant in and the tabernacle was there, this is before the temple was built by Solomon, David instituted musical worship, music and vocals, singing and instruments of worship, and this was organized. These were people that were good at it. You know, and you know, I know that you've been to like the elementary school, you know, thing, and I'm not talking about the ones that your kids are at, because the ones that your kids are at are great. But the ones that, you know, have other kids, usually musically, it's kind of like the nails on the chalkboard kind of feeling. You know, and you're listening, you're going, oh man, this is just not good. Well, David wasn't into bad music. He wasn't into out of tune and everything, and he handpicked people to be worship leaders, and he handpicked the people that would be the singers and the instrumentalists, and he found people that were tone deaf but had good rhythm. They had the cymbals, you know, and that's where we get all our drummers, tone deaf people with good rhythm, you know. I'm just kidding. And so David did this, and these were the singers and the instrumentalists and things, and they ministered, it says in verse 32, with song before the tabernacle of the tent of meeting until Solomon had built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, and they served in their office according to their order. So it was a selected bunch of people out of the Levites that were able to do this. Now, the Kohathites that were the descendants of Aaron, we see that in verse 49. And we already talked about this a bit. Aaron and his sons offered on the altar of burnt offering and on the altar of incense for all the work of the most holy place and to make atonement for Israel according to all that Moses, the servant of God, had commanded. So again, the priests were part of the Kohathites, but not all of the Kohathites, just the ones that came from Aaron. Another part of being a Levite was that God didn't give them any land. When they crossed over the Jordan River and into the Promised Land, the land was divided up into all these tribes got land except the Levites. You know, it's like, hey, what about us? Well, God said, no, your portion is me. I am your portion. See, they get land, but you get me. And that might have sounded kind of hokey at first. It's like, well, thanks, Lord, but what are we going to do until we die, you know, and go to heaven? We need a place to live. We need we need to farm, you know, we need cities. Well, God had already taken care of all that and told all of the tribes that they were to set aside cities and the pasture land around those certain cities. This is all within their, like within the borders of the tribe of Issachar, there would be Levitical cities. Hey, you guys get this city and all the pasture land around it. And that's how God made sure that they had places to live and farming and all those kind of things. Numbers 35 kind of gives us a summary of that. As the book of Numbers is just about drawing to a close, we see that God told Moses, command the sons of Israel. This is chapter 35, verse 2 of the book of Numbers. Command the sons of Israel that they give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possession cities to live in. And you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. The cities shall be theirs to live in, and their pasture land shall be for their cattle and their herds and for all their beasts. So that's the story there. Also, six of those cities were to be designated as cities of refuge. Cities of refuge. Remember, and we don't have the time to cover it all tonight, but basically, if you're chopping wood and the axe head flies off of the axe and hits your partner in the head and kills him, if you stick around and wait for people to find out about this, what's going to happen is this guy's brother is going to kill you. He doesn't care about the circumstances. He doesn't care that it's an accident. He is called... Don't move that. He is called the Avenger of Blood. And he is this near kinsman that has the cultural right to kill you for doing this. And so the city of refuge is that place to which you run until you can get a fair trial. And if you're found innocent, then you stay there and they can't kill you. If you're found guilty, then the guy gets to kill you. That's kind of guilty of murder. If you premeditated this, I mean, if you like waited for him, you know, and you had like stood over him with a rock or something, you know. So that's the story with that. They're also to get the, it says in verse 57, to the sons of Aaron, they gave the following cities of refuge and then lists these. Interesting that it was the sons of Aaron, not just the Kohathites, but the sons of Aaron, the priests, who were given charge of the cities of refuge, and they were to mandate this. That, and we talked about this in Deuteronomy recently, about the idea of the law of the cops and the judges being spiritual guys, you know, about being priestly guys. Instead of having some unbelieving judge, you know, being at the mercy of a guy who doesn't understand mercy, of being, you know, at the end of the gavel, you know, of a guy who doesn't know the Lord. The whole idea in God's system is the godliest guys are supposed to be the judges. The most honorable people in the eyes of the Lord, those are supposed to be the cops. That's the whole idea. So that's the way that was supposed to be. So that's all of chapter 6, pretty much. This is kind of sounding a little bit like Sunday nights, isn't it? It's just jam through, go, 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 turn the pages quick. Chapter 7, we look at Issachar. Now, again, first five verses dedicated to Issachar, not a lot of space here. And what's funny is that if you look up Issachar and Issachar's descendants, which I did a lot this week because I was just convinced I was missing something, and so hours and hours, you know, and realized it's not just that there's not much space given here, it's that not much space is given in the Bible to Issachar's descendants. As a matter of fact, in the entire Bible, I was able to find one notable guy that came from Issachar. I'm not dogging Issachar. I'm sure he was a great guy and had great kids. But as far as Bible characters go, there's one guy that I could find, and that was Tola in the book of Judges. You might remember that he, and you don't probably remember anything he did, but you'll remember this. He was the son of Pua, the son of Dodo. You remember that judge now? Oh yeah, the grandson of Dodo. I remember him. He was one of the judges in the book of Judges, in Judges chapter 10. Tola, that's it. He's from Issachar. I can't find anybody else that's noteworthy. It is interesting that it seems that they're, what would you call them, the forefathers. He was one of the descendants of Issachar's son of the same name, because it details that Issachar had a son named Tola, and that his descendants, there was 22,600 of them, they were mighty men of valor in their generations. And it would seem that then he must have been one of these guys that was named after a great, 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 great Grandpa Tola, Grandpa Tola. So you remember the Grandpa Tola Khomeini? No. Okay. You know, there's just not much funny here, okay? I'm working with what I got. All right. So chapter 7 continues. Verse 6 starts out detailing the, basically briefly listing the descendants of Benjamin. And you think, man, Benjamin should be more significant than this. Actually, he is, and all of chapter 8 is going to go back and give a more detailed thing regarding Benjamin. Then you want to know shortchanged here. Verse 13, the sons of Naphtali. That's it. Verse 13, and I'm not even going to read their names, but the very much like the tribe of Issachar, the tribe of Naphtali is like, where's the famous people? You know, did you ever go to school where nobody famous went? The school just up the road, not here, but I went to high school at La Quinta High School. Up the road was another high school, and you know, Steve Martin went to that high school, you know, and people would bring in the yearbooks and go, look, there's Steve Martin, prom king. He had black hair back then and stuff. And I always wondered, what famous person went to La Quinta High School? You know, I mean, except for me. And I'm just kidding. Nobody famous ever. And then it happened. There was a guy, he was in the military stationed in West Germany, back when there was West Germany and East Germany. And he stole a bunch of American secrets in a briefcase. You remember this? And hopped the wall and defected into communist Germany. Do you remember that? He went to my high school. That's it. That's it. That's the famous guy. Anyway, Naphtali, and that's like a bummer of a famous person. You know, it's like most people go, I don't even remember that. Naphtali, the only famous guy I can find from Naphtali, was the guy that Solomon hired to do the bronze work in the temple. Yeah, and then he hopped the wall into Germany. That's it. And that's it. You know, I have to share these things with you because after like 2 hours of studying, you know, Naphtali and coming up with zilch and then just getting this, it's like, you know what? You guys deserve to be tortured as well with this information. So anyway, we are now in... I wonder if I even wrote that down, the bronze worker. I did. If you want to look that up, it's in 1 Kings chapter 7. You can read that whole chapter. No, really, you have to read that whole chapter. Okay, verse 14 starts out the descendants of Manasseh. And this is a tough one, and I don't want to bore you with all the details. But... it's kind of tough to figure out if this is a continuing thing of the other half-tribe of Manasseh or if this is the other half-tribe of Manasseh. You know, there's a couple of them. One stayed on that side. The other one kind of got absorbed in. So really, it's tough. There's a lot of similar names. And basically, verses 14 through 19, there you have it, descendants of Manasseh. But then on through verses 20 to 29 talks about Ephraim. Now, Manasseh and Ephraim are listed here as sons of Jacob, sons of Israel. Technically they are, but biologically they're grandsons. Remember Joseph? Joseph was the guy who got beat up by his brothers. He was one of the last to be born. Remember Rachel? She was barren for all that time. Three women had kids before her, but now she has Joseph. Joseph ends up with the long-sleeved coat, translated the coat of many colors. He ends up being the manager over all his brothers and stuff. They hate him. They beat him up, throw him into a pit, sell him into slavery. He ends up in Egypt and ends up being basically vice pharaoh of Egypt. Has a couple of kids, Manasseh and Ephraim. So technically Manasseh and Ephraim are grandsons of Israel, not sons of Israel. But then when remember Joseph, he's vice pharaoh. He has Jacob, Israel, and all his family come and live in the region of Egypt there, come out of during this famine. A lot of history that I'm just skimming over, but they live there, and ultimately Jacob is dying of old age and he's on his deathbed, and Joseph brings the two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, these guys that have been born in Egypt. And Jacob, because of Reuben's rebellion, because of his lack of self-control, he's not going to get the double portion. Joseph is the one that Jacob wants to give the double portion to, but legally you can't really do that. So what he does is he says, I'm adopting your two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. That's how I'm giving you the double portion. And that's how he did it. So he adopted them. Basically, they became sons. Now, I thought for sure, I guess not. I might have covered that too early. I might not have put that in my notes. But I think that's around Genesis 48. That's a guess, but I think it's probably a pretty good guess. All right. Anyway, here it is right here, Genesis 48. See, it was a great guess. Here's something that I find interesting, and maybe it's the first thing you'll find interesting in the whole night, or maybe you'll just walk away going, man, I should have watched ER. And that is this. The 12 tribes of Israel, right? We counted them. It was at the beginning of 1 Chronicles 2. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Joseph, Benjamin, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, 12. Didn't Israel just adopt Manasseh and Ephraim? How do you get 12 tribes out of that? I mean, it sounds like 14. Although technically it wouldn't be 14. It would be more like 13, because could you count Joseph? Because Manasseh and Ephraim were each count as tribes, and so wouldn't that be the 13 tribes of Israel? And so you've got a possibility of 12, 13, or 14. And it's always really strange to read about the 12 tribes of Israel when you know there's more than that, and yet God always seems to work it out. You see, the land, when they moved in to the promised land, what did God do? God divided out all the portions of land, right? How many portions? Well, remember, Levi didn't get his portion, so should have been 11, but it was really 12. Because Joseph was really Manasseh and Ephraim, and they were two different things. So there was 12 portions of land, even though Levi didn't get any. And sometimes they're being counted. To me, and maybe I'm not communicating this in a confusing enough manner, but for years I've really struggled in this, that there's this whole idea of, is it 12 or is it 13 or 14? God always makes it work out to 12. The way he always works it out to 12 is that he eliminates Levi for whatever reason, because either they're not allowed to go to war, or because they didn't inherit the land or whatever, and you still end up with 12 because the descendants of Joseph or the sons of Joseph were adopted, Manasseh and Ephraim. Or if he wants to include Levi, he still manages to get 12 because he just says the tribe of Joseph, combining Manasseh and Ephraim together. Confused yet? No. Okay. So God always keeps it at 12. And so you say, okay, I think I've got it now. If he eliminates Levi, he includes Manasseh and Ephraim. If he wants to include Levi, he just counts Joseph, and no matter how you do it, you get 12, right? The book of Revelation talks about the 144,000 Jews. 12,000 from this tribe, 12,000 from that tribe, 12,000 from that tribe. 12 times 12 comes out to 144. 12 times 12,000, 144,000. You've got 12 tribes. Which is it going to be? Is he going to eliminate the Levites? Or is he only going to include Joseph and not include Manasseh and Ephraim? Well, Revelation chapter 7, and this is why this always messes with my mind. Because the list given of the 144,000 is Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, all the guys we'd expect. Then also in verse 6, Manasseh. And so we think, okay, it's not going to be Joseph, it's going to be Ephraim, and that means Levi won't be in the list. Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph. Man, this messes with my mind. It's like, wait a second, what happened to Ephraim? Well, you could say, well, since he's counting Manasseh, then Joseph would count as Ephraim. Maybe you could get away with that, but somebody ain't there. the 144,000 Jews, there's a tribe not listed because Joseph and Manasseh are included in here, which you could assume Ephraim's in there. But Levi's also included. Who's missing? Well, I won't make you do all the headwork. It's Dan. Interesting that Dan means judgment. But I don't know why. Also, because it's possible that it was the tribe of Dan that really introduced idolatry into Israel. I don't know why, but God always makes it work out to 12. And so, anyway, there you go. That'll keep you up at night. Or maybe it'll put you to sleep. Maybe it already has. So, we're back in 1 Chronicles chapter 7. It's finishing up from verses 30 to 40, talking about the descendants of Asher. Those 11 verses basically giving us his genealogy and lineage. And then all of chapter 8 is dedicated to Benjamin. And remember, we had a brief one earlier on, but now we've got the whole chapter dedicated. And Benjamin was the tribe from which Paul the Apostle came. Remember, he was Saul of Tarsus, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Pharisee of Pharisees. He's a notable guy from the tribe of Benjamin. But there was a Saul before the Apostle Paul. He was the first king, King Saul, son of Kish. Now, I don't know about his dad, but Saul was a real man. Kish, maybe not so much. You have to be old to remember that. There was a book years ago called Real Men Don't Eat Kish. So just all the 20-year-olds went, oh, really? Okay. So what you see in this genealogy of Benjamin in chapter 8, verse 33, Ner became the father of Kish, and Kish became the father of Saul. Saul ended up being king, obviously, and lists his son, Jonathan, and the rest of the guys. So that's chapter 8, finally chapter 9. Oh, how time flies. Chapter 9 starts out, so all Israel was enrolled by genealogies, and behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel. Oh, 1 and 2 Kings, all this is written in there. Let's go back and read all that. No, okay, we won't. Anyway, it is all written in there. Here's the deal, though. And I've been making fun of all this for a purpose. I don't usually go through Bible studies and go, yawn, boring, you know, come on. But let's face it, when you do your devotional reading and you come to these things, you skip those days. Or you go, blah, 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 battle, 17 Philistines killed, blah, 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 blah. You know, and I mean, you're catching the highlights. But I'll tell you what, these names that are so hard to pronounce and difficult to study and boring to read in your devotions, these names were the most interesting part to the Jews who kept these records, because to the Jews, the whole fact that they were enrolled by genealogies, at least one thing and possibly two things were vitally important to them. Number one, as we've talked about, when God brought the people into the land, the promised land, the land of Canaan, what did he do? He divvied up the land by tribe. And those lands were divvied up by the clans of the tribe, and those lands were divvied up by the families of the tribe. And so a person's family plot, not the family plot at the cemetery, but the family land, if you couldn't prove your genealogy, you couldn't prove that it was yours. The nice thing is that even if you sold it, it would eventually come back to you. At worst case, the year of Jubilee, after 50 years, it would always come back to you if you could prove your genealogy. So these things were vitally important to them. All their property rights were focused around it. Even more important to those guys from the tribe of Levi, from the clan of the Kohathites, from the part of the family that came from Aaron, their jobs depended on it. Because you had to prove that you were a Levite of the clan of Kohath, of the line of Aaron, if you were going to serve as a priest. And in the book of Ezra, you might remember this, in Ezra, when they came back from the Babylonian captivity, I don't hear any pages turning, so I'll just read it to you. Ezra said in chapter 2, verse 62, that he talks about these guys that searched among their ancestral registration, but they could not be located. Therefore, they were considered unclean and excluded from the priesthood. Their job, being priest, you can't prove your ancestry, you can't do it. Now, a number of years ago, I guess I was in seventh grade, my father and I went through a hunter safety class down in San Diego. Took the thing, aced all the tests, did good. It was an interesting class, and got my hunter safety card in seventh grade. By eighth grade, I didn't know where my hunter safety card was. And then when I moved up here and some of the guys in the church were going, hey, let's go hunting this, you know, antelope season, deer season, elk season, whatever. And I'm like, I need a hunter safety card, you know, and I know I got that before. And so I'll just call the, you know, county of San Diego. I'm sure they'll have that on the computer. Well, when I was in seventh grade, everything was on abacus. There's no computers. And I said, well, surely there must be a paper record. And she said, well, my name's Kelly, not Shirley. And I said, there must be paper records. And they said, well, yeah, there would be, except the courthouse that stored all that in the basement had a fire and it all burned down. So, you know. And I said, well, I remember the name of my instructor. Could I track him down? You know, and it just became this big mess of I couldn't go hunting with any of the guys in the church that year because I didn't have time to take I'm kind of busy on weekends. You're familiar with this. I'm here on Sundays. And I'm busy during midweeks when you can take this at night. So I've never been able to do this. And too young to be grandfathered in. So that's my frustration. I just thought I'd share that with you. But these guys, I mean, this was their job. That's just a little recreational, you know, couple of days out in the woods tromping around and shooting at stuff. But they're talking about their job. They're talking about being a priest. You can't be a priest because you don't have the paperwork, because you can't prove it. What's the paperwork? It's all this stuff, chapters 1 through 9 that we've been looking at, that you go, yawn, boring, I can't wait to get out of this. Let's get on to the other stuff. To them, this was vitally important. And so, you know, one man's trash, another man's treasure. I don't know how you put that. But the second half of chapter 9, verse 1 says, and Judah was carried away into exile to Babylon for their unfaithfulness. So now we get to the Babylonian captivity. The Assyrians had come in, carried off the 10 tribes. Maybe I should probably back up. How many minutes do I have? 6,000 minutes. All right. Judah was carried away into exile. Now, if you read the rest of chapter 9, which we will not, as far as I'm concerned, this is the last verse we're reading. You can read the rest of chapter 9. And that big rushing wind was everybody's sigh of relief. Judah, now, if you read the rest of the chapter, you're going to see that he's talking about the region, not the people. Now, it includes the people of Judah, but it's the region, because if you notice, there's all these tribes listed that were taken away and then brought back when Nebuchadnezzar came in and with the Babylonian captivity, killed a bunch of them and carted a lot of them away. Now, what we have to do is we have to look at David was king, then Solomon was king, then his son Rehoboam became king. But Rehoboam was a brutal guy, and he said, oh, you think my dad was bad? I'm going to be 100 times worse. Well, because of Solomon's sin, his dad's sin, God had said, I'm going to split the nation up. I'm going to tear it away from you. I have an obligation to your father David to keep you as king, but I'm only going to make you king over this one small southern part. The other 10 tribes up here, they are all going to rebel. And so Jeroboam was raised up. Jeroboam became the king of the northern kingdom of Israel. Solomon's son Rehoboam was king over this smaller southern kingdom of Judah. Now, Jeroboam up in the north knew that the Jewish law said 3 times a year you have to go down to Jerusalem for these feasts and offer these sacrifices and things. And he thought, man, if these 10 tribes of people who live up here with me, if they go down, man, their hearts are going to be drawn back to the Lord and drawn back to the Lord's servant David and the kingly line. I can't let that happen. So he had 2 golden calves constructed. And he put them in 2 different cities up there in the northern kingdom and said, behold your gods, O Israel. He said, you know, it's too much. This is in 1 Kings chapter 12. It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up from the land of Egypt. Now, not being very biblically minded at this point, because the people were in rebellion, they thought, oh yeah, golden calf, gods who brought you out of Egypt. Yeah, sure, we remember that. This sounds right. Now, this thing became a sin, 1 Kings 12 says. For the people went to worship before one as far as Dan. These were in Bethel and in Dan. And also, you could consider that Dan was the one eliminated from Revelation, if you make a note there. And he made houses on high places and made priests from among all the people who were not of the sons of Levi. So he's picking people for the priesthood no matter what. Oh, you want to be a priest? Sure, you can be a priest. So he's really messing things up. And so the apostasy, it permeated the whole northern kingdom. And what we see in the scriptures is that the people whose hearts were truly for the Lord, no matter what tribe they were from, they migrated southward down to Jerusalem and the surrounding area. That's why at the Babylonian captivity, when Judah was taken away, all of the tribes were represented. Because the Assyrian captivity, when those people were carted away, they were wiped out, never to be heard from again. But God still has tracked all of the tribes of Israel because these godly people migrated southward. Now, they didn't stay godly for long, ultimately 70 years in Babylon. But in Ezra and Nehemiah, we see they came back and all of the tribes are represented. And that is what the rest of chapter 9 is, listing all of these people from all of these tribes who returned from the Babylonian captivity. So the chronicler has taken us all the way from the sons of Israel to Israel's return from the Babylonian captivity. And then next week in chapter 10, we'll actually get into some action, you know, rather than words sort of thing, and look at lots of events and not a lot of genealogies. So let's pray. Father, thank you that you have given us your word. And Lord, we know it's all important. It's all vital for instruction. And Lord, some of it, it's nothing that we could really keep kids' attention with in a Sunday school class by reading genealogies. And yet, there's a lot of stuff in there, Lord, that it's important to either learn or to refresh our memories. Certainly, it was important to these people. And Father, we thank you that if we look at just the phone book of Cheyenne, we could get bored doing that and look through and name after name after name. And yet, you know all of our names. And you know the number of hairs on our head. You're concerned about us individually. And so, Lord, every name in that phone book is a person that you care about. And in the same way, every name that we've seen in the scriptures here was someone that you loved, that you are, that were the creator of, and that you desired to reach out to you in repentance and in love. So, Lord, while we look at these big groups of people, help us to look at them as individuals the same way that you look at us. Thank you, Lord, that you know our name, that you know our heart and you test our minds, and that you care, that you love us. And so, Lord, thanks for that reminder. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.